The next file set for the argument this morning is State of South Dakota versus James Joseph Lamphere Jr. Cody Miller is present, will be arguing on behalf of the defendant appellant, Mr. Lamphere, and Aaron Hanke is present and will be arguing on behalf of the State of South Dakota. Each side will have 15 minutes for your initial argument, and then Mr. Miller, you'll have a 5-minute rebuttal. So with that, you can proceed with your argument, Mr. Miller.
Mr. Chief Justice, Associate Justices, Counsel, and may it please the Court, my name is Cody Miller. It is my privilege today to be present before this Court on this cold, snowy Valentine's Day morning, to be present for this Court oral argument, and I represent James Joseph Lamphere Jr. as the appellant in this matter. This is an appeal arising from a judgment of conviction from June of 2023 by the Circuit Court, which sentenced Mr. Lamphere to 2 concurrent life sentences. This is a case which can be summarized into one overarching issue, whether the sentence imposed was appropriate. This umbrella issue can be broken down and approached from 2 different angles. First, through the Eighth Amendment to the United States Constitution, as the sentence was cruel and unusual. And second, through an abuse of discretion standard, on the grounds that the trial court imposed a sentence which is impermissible and it was arbitrary or unreasonable. Under the first route, under the Eighth Amendment to the United States Constitution, we're all afforded with the right to be free from cruel and unusual punishment. In the cited State v. Saplacha, which cites back to State v. Rice, a 2016 case, a 2-prong approach is provided for a de novo review from this court. The first prong, a determination of a sentence that is disproportionate to the corresponding offense, and the second prong is a determination that the sentence is disproportionate to similarly situated defendants in the same jurisdiction for the same offense. Under that first prong, this court must first decide if the sentence imposed was grossly disproportionate to its corresponding offense. The legislature has passed SDCL 22-18-1.05, which affords for the aggravated assault on law enforcement as a Class 2 felony. The legislature also passed penalties for felonies under SDCL 22-6-1, and provides that Class 2 felonies provided a maximum sentence of 25 years and or a $50,000 fine. The legislature has taken out the guesswork and provided that the appropriate or proportional sentence for aggravated assault on law enforcement should be in the range of 0 to 25 years. The legislature, I acknowledge, has also passed the statute 22-7-8 for habitual offenders and specifically provides that a defendant that has 3-plus prior criminal convictions, one of which is includes a crime of violence, their felony would be enhanced then to a Class C. This was a legislative decision which allows for enhanced sentences by escalating the class of the crime based solely on criminal history. But this enhanced range of sentences would apply across the board to all naturally set Class C felonies as well as any felonies that were enhanced to that Class C. Although it allows for an enhanced sentence such as that which was imposed, it does not prescribe any certain sentence, nor even that the sentence must be enhanced in any regard from the underlying crime's typical sentence range. Additionally, and on point with this first prong analysis, I argue that the legislature, in allowing for a broad enhancement covering so many different combinations of criminal histories, regardless of any factors other than criminal history, does not change the proportionality of the crime which has been determined and codified. Effectively, a person with an aggravated assault, which is a crime of violence, and 2 prior felony theft or damage to property convictions, who is now facing another felony, damage to property, or theft, is facing a sentencing range up to life. But I think we would all agree that a life sentence for a felony-level intentional damage to property would be disproportionate, even though allowed by statute. The escalation from a sentence the legislature found to be proportional at 0 to 25 years to a life sentence is disproportionate.
Yeah, but we have to examine the gravity of this offense, not necessarily at this stage. You know, we're not really concerned so much with individual aspects of sentencing like we would at the abuse of discretion stage, but we're still looking at the gravity of this class of offenses, which is an aggravated assault, and it's an aggravated assault upon a law enforcement officer. And it's one which invokes the recidivist enhancement, as you acknowledge, that our legislature has passed. So it's really not apples and apples to say that this generic recidivist enhancement really doesn't matter much to the gravity assessment. I'm not saying that, forgive me if I'm paraphrasing in the wrong way, but it seems like it does matter. And it seems like our cases recognize that the recidivist enhancement, which expands the statutory maximum penalty, matters.
I would agree that it matters. I don't think that it's irrelevant, the recidivism habitual offender statute. It's certainly not irrelevant. But I think what it does is it allows for a greater enhanced sentence over the proportionate 0 to 25 standard that was set. But I think it takes additional factors in aggravation that need to be specifically listed and found, not just enough in the history, but when you take and this is kind of goes and in, bleeds into the second prong analysis, is looking at the specific factors of the individual act and the history of the individual defendant. So I don't think it's irrelevant. I do think it does matter.
And I know you didn't. I didn't mean it that way. But I think that this is the class of offenses. It's not as if that you know, you could take a lower level felony and say, you know, even a lower level felony could in some instances be enhanced by this generic method of enhancement to a life sentence, and our case is you know, so there's sort of this disconnect with this enhancement relative to this offense. I understand your argument, but we're looking at this particular class of offenses, and is it grave?
If I'm understanding your question, when you're talking about the apples to apples, I think what you're referring to is me mentioning the felony level theft or intentional damage, and I can appreciate that. I think that the statute for enhancement allows for greater sentences, and it would apply across the board. But to address the idea of it apples to apples, comparing it to an aggravated assault, which I think is where you're going, I still think the statute originally set the crime at a class 2 felony. And then the enhancement, although it allows for sentencing up to a Class C, it's still a Class 2 felony. Going into this second prong analysis, the court must decide whether or not the sentence was disproportionate when compared to sentences imposed on other criminals in the same jurisdiction for the same crime.
We have to look at the harshness, first of all. We have to look at the gravity of the offense, and we have to look at the harshness of this sentence, too, don't we?
Are you talking about on the first prong or on the second prong analysis?
First prong.
On the first prong analysis, I think that the legislature's already taken out that guesswork as far as it's a Class 2 felony. So the proportionality of the sentence should be in that 0 to 25 range. I suppose you could say with an asterisk that if the habitual offender is in there that it can be escalated. But as I argued, I don't believe that habitual offender prescribes that it must be now up to the maximum or that you even must enhance it. It just allows for it to be enhanced.
But to get to Justice Salter's earlier point, again, when we're looking at the gravity of the offense, regardless of the enhancement, if you're comparing it to a possession of controlled substance, minimal amount of controlled substance on a needle, let's say, versus law enforcement officer aggravated assault, those are two very different offenses. Would you agree?
I would agree with that. I think, though, it goes back to what the legislature has already decided, that would be a Class 2 felony with the maximum of 25 years. And it doesn't take into specific effects or effects where, you know, let's say the federal sentencing guidelines would if there was, you know, a certain weapon used, or if there was some element of torture that was also included. Those types of points that would go in the federal system that the state system doesn't afford for that. So I do think that those are different needles or apples to oranges type of situation. But if you're comparing an aggravated assault to another aggravated assault, although the sentence could be enhanced, I still think that the legislature's decided that 0 to 25 is that proportional area, with the asterisk that you could go above because of certain factors, whether it was certain facts of the specific crime or maybe it was the vast amount of criminal history that they have, that type of thing.
So in order to have a more discrete examination, step two of proportionality, we first have to complete step one, which we're talking about. Step one requires us to compare the gravity of the offense, which is to say the offense's relative position on the spectrum of all criminality, everything, A to Z. And compare that against the harshness of the penalty, which is where the harshness of this sentence landed on the spectrum of all authorized punishment. When we do that, we look at the gravity of the offense. In this case, we compare it to the harshness of the sentence that was imposed. What about that suggests gross disproportionality, such that we would even be authorized to go to the second step?
Well, I think it goes back to the argument I've been making, is that the legislature has already decided that. I understand the A to Z, where does this crime fit on, with the needle on that spectrum? Well, I think the legislature has decided that that's at that 0 to 25, that Class 2 felony level, and it doesn't afford for life.
But that argument almost would suggest that anytime you have an enhancement above the statutory maximum, that violates... that's grossly disproportionate.
Well, and I'm not saying that it would be grossly disproportionate, because obviously that statute has some meaning, but I think that allows the sentencing court to go above the I don't know if you want to say plain Jane ag assault, because that's not really appropriate term, but it allows, with an asterisk, to go above the 25, saying that because there's an enhanced criminal history with this individual, that we're going to allow for a heightened sentence. The same sentence is allowable as a Class C felony, and that case happens to be up to life. And at no point do I make an argument that statutorily that this is not permitted. It's clearly within the parameters of what the statutes allow. But what I think is what makes it grossly disproportionate is that it has taken and gone from that 0 to 25 and drastically jumped it up to life. The maximum sentence for a Class C for a crime that has been decided by the legislature is a Class 2.
Do we still look at the particular conduct of these aggravated assault charges here?
I think that would more come into the analysis on the second prong, which is what I was hoping to get to. So the first prong is...
So is this the one where you would compare them to other sentences?
Correct. Because the second prong is comparing them to other similarly situated defendants in the same jurisdiction facing the same offenses.
If you have some extra time, and I hate to preempt anything, but I'd like to hear your abuse of discretion argument.
The abuse of discretion? So on the abuse of discretion argument, the standard there is whether the trial court made an impermissible choice. I argue that the trial court made an impermissible choice, one that was arbitrary and or unreasonable, in that the court failed to take a thorough accounting of the character and history of the man before the court, and failed to adequately consider all the Hinger-Bonner factors fairly. The trial court had given credence when comparing some of these other cases to this idea that in the Hanneman, specifically Stabe Hanneman file, that the defendant in that case was dealing with mental health issues. Here, the court doesn't seem to acknowledge that same factor, which was in the Hanneman case in support of a mitigating sentence, but that was also present in our case, that Mr. Lanford was also suffering from mental health, chemical dependency issues, and he was actively being treated for those issues while he was incarcerated for this file, and he's had those struggles in the past as well.
It seems like the sentencing court regarded this, notwithstanding the plea to aggravated assault, as very much an attempted murder. Our cases talk about that. They allow a sentencing judge to reflect and determine what we have sometimes described as the true nature of an offense. Your client disclaims that, says he wasn't trying to hurt anybody. That's very much controverted. Is that the judge's call to make that determination as to the true nature of this offense? Is it more like a traditional, what we might think of as an aggravated assault? Or was it something that was negotiated as part of this plea agreement but still looks and resembles more of a attempted murder sort of look? Who makes that call in terms of what this case really looks like?
You know, it's a good question, and it's a difficult one for any judge to deal with, because on one hand, he's innocent until proven guilty on certain charges, and on this one, although it appears as though it was pled down, I disagree with that. I understand that it's controverted that, you know, a murder would have stuck or whatnot. But I do believe that it would be very difficult for the state to have proven that, and I think that's why the state came down to the way they did. So for the court to make an assumption, to make that decision without hearing all the facts, that in fact it was a murder charge or a murder case in which he could have been convicted, I believe goes against his right to be proven to be innocent until proven guilty.
Court would have to have some evidence, but of course the rules of evidence in a strict sense don't apply at the sentencing. The pre-sentence investigation, which had certainly some facts, but an unsworn statement from a trooper that said he looked right at me and pointed the gun right at me. And fired. So it seems like the court might have had some information, at least, if not evidence in a strict sense, but it's sentencing. It seems like the court might have had some information before it that would allow it to make a factual determination that looks more like attempted murder than aggravated assault. But maybe you disagree.
Well, I guess I would disagree to the extent that there was evidence to the contrary as well. Not only did Mr. Lanfer indicate that he had no intentions to harm anybody, but also the evidence that was there supported that. There was no bullet holes in the police vehicle except for those that were fired from the trooper through his own windshield. There were none on the cement around them, obviously none in the officers, thank goodness, but none in the buildings behind the officers in their backdrop, or nothing that the state could prove was in the vicinity whatsoever. So although that trooper may have had the perspective that gun is pointing in my direction, that could have been well over the tops of the houses, but doesn't show that there was that premeditated intent to end the officer's life.
So, counsel, when the trooper pulled up behind Mr. Lanfear, he stepped out, pointed the rifle directly at the officer. Did he fire his gun at that point?
Did Mr. Lanfear
fire? Yes.
So in watching the video, and I've watched it many times in slow motion, zoomed in the best I could, I think there's a bit of a delay when you hear the shots anyways in the video, but it sounds like when the officer pulls up, the gun is pointed, again, it's pixelated, so I don't know the level that it's pointed at, but it's in the general direction of the officer, and shots do go off as the trooper is pulling up, and he's...
So Lanfear fired shots as the trooper's pulling up.
Correct, and he's always stated that was his intention was always to scare troopers back. When they would get too close in their pursuit, he would shoot out the window, make them back up. He was trying to escape.
And then the officer fired 11 rounds through his windshield.
Correct.
All right, now you've referenced the surveillance videos. What is depicted in the videos, specifically the East River Co-op? Apparently, the sentencing judge also viewed the videos, and there's reference to that. They were included with the PSI, but they're not in the record.
Mm-hmm.
You've seen the videos. What's depicted in the videos? How many were there, and what was depicted?
So there was, if I remember right, there was two different angles as the patrol car, or as the defendant's vehicle and the line of officers is coming behind him as it goes down the street. Facing generally towards a park, as he's going, as the vehicle is driving by, you can see the firearm come out of the vehicle. It's not real clear on what direction specifically. You know, he's not hanging out the window, pointing it, aiming, looking through the scope or anything like that at officers. It's more of a backward and up angle, is what I guess I would describe it as. And then, of course, you can see that shots go off because I don't even remember. I don't believe there was sound on those videos. But then all the individuals in the park, after a short delay, as typical, they all kind of take cover.
Did you consider those to be part of the record in the case?
The videos to be a part of the record? Yes, I would consider those to be part of the record. Those were presented to the judge by the state prior to sentencing.
Thank you.
Unless there's other questions, Mr. Miller, you can finish up on rebuttal.
Thank you.
Sankey, you may proceed.
May it please the court, counsel. There was a lot of discussion on the Eighth Amendment two-prong analysis, and that first prong being the gravity of the offense compared to the harshness of the penalty. When I am presented with an Eighth Amendment analysis, I think of it with two parallel lines, one on top of the other. And our top line is the harshness of the offense. And on the far right side of that line, we have our petty offenses, our class two misdemeanors, class one. And you kind of go along the line, dropping the different crimes on their where they belong. And on the far left, of course, we have the harshest crimes in South Dakota, which are homicide crimes. But aggravated assault against law enforcement is on the harsh end of our spectrum of severity of crimes. It's not a no seatbelt ticket. It's not a possession of drug paraphernalia. It is on the harsh end of the spectrum. In fact, outside of our homicide crimes, I don't know that there's a statute more severe than aggravated assault against law enforcement. And it's not aggravated assault. It is aggravated assault against law enforcement, which our legislature has specifically given a higher criminal classification to. It is a class two felony. So in my little hypothetical timeline or spectrum here, aggravated assault against law enforcement is on the far left end of severity of the crime. So then when we move to the harshness of the offense, again, we have another little line where on the far right we have fines, maybe some jail time, prison time, and then obviously the most severe punishment a person can receive in South Dakota is the death penalty. The life sentence is right next to that. But again, both the severity of the crime and the harshness of the offense are both on the left side of their perspective spectrums. So they're not grossly disproportionate. In fact, they are right in line with each other. And Mr. Miller was talking about, well, the legislature only authorized a 25-year sentence here, but that's not how we do an Eighth Amendment analysis. We look at the entire spectrum of all permissible penalties available to a judge in any way, in any crime, which goes from which goes to fines, zero jail time, clear up till the death sentence. And so we're not just limited as to what has been authorized for a class two felony.
Nor are we, yes, we're not limited to that statutory maximum in a case where there's a recidivist enhancement as well. Our case is CHIPS recognizes precedent from the United States Supreme Court that says recidivist enhancements like these also reflect the legislature's judgment that a particular offense that qualifies for that treatment is more grave.
Correct. Correct. And when we're doing an Eighth Amendment analysis, we're looking specifically at the crime versus the penalty. We're not getting into the individual characteristics of the defendant. The only thing that would come into play with an Eighth Amendment analysis is that part two under the recidivism statute, which enhances to me the gravity of the offense because you have these prior convictions. So you're not just coming with a clean slate. You do have those prior convictions coming with you. So again, it makes a more harsh crime, if that makes sense.
Well, I do gravity, and then I do harshness on the other line, but I know what you mean.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry. So because the gravity of the offense and the harshness of the sentence are not disproportionate, there's no reason to go to the second prong of that, the Eighth Amendment test, which is where we compare Lamford's sentence to those similarly situated defendants in similarly situated jurisdictions. There's no need to compare because they're not grossly disproportionate. Moving on to the abuse of discretion standard argument, the circuit court has a broad range of things it can consider. And Justice Salter, I believe you were asking Mr. Miller some questions about, yes, Lanphier pled guilty to aggravated assault against law enforcement, but can the court consider or kind of treat this as an attempted murder case, as he was charged with attempted murder? I understand he pled guilty, that was dismissed. But yes, the court considers all of Lanphier's conduct. My understanding is the factual basis behind the aggravated assault against law enforcement to which he pled was after his car ran out of gas, he stopped in Madison, got out of the vehicle, and then pointed and fired his weapon at the two officers. That is the aggravated assault against law enforcement for which he pled guilty to. But we have a lot of events going on that day in Lake County and also in other jurisdictions, and the court has all of that information to consider when it's fashioning its sentence.
Right. I don't know that the court can just say, hey, the dismissed conduct could have been worse, and so I can consider the specter of it. I think it seems to me like the court should have some information or evidence or something like that. But it looks like the record has that. Evidence, that is.
Yes, certainly in the PSI, there was all sorts of law enforcement reports, not necessarily about this instance, but I know they did a hearing for other acts evidence before the case was pled to, where there was some prior conduct, too, that the court got a little bit more insight to. Again, becoming familiar with land for the person before him.
So are the videos part of the pre-sentence investigation?
No, Your Honor. My understanding is videos were presented to the court. The court viewed the videos, but they were not included in the PSI. They were not admitted into the record.
So you do not consider them part of the record?
Because the circuit court judge did view those, I think they should. I personally think they should be viewed that way. I can't speak to how the prosecuting attorney in this situation viewed them, but I think anything the circuit court views should be considered part of the record.
Thank you.
There was also some discussion as to mitigating factors the circuit court should have considered, or other factors, or this factor wasn't weighed as heavily as this factor. And again, that's up to the circuit court to determine how they're going to view the evidence. They are given a lot of information, and the courts are then given the opportunity to sift through all of that and how they weigh the evidence. And this circuit court in particular stated that it studied the PSI, read all of the documents contained within, watched the videos, and taken all of that into consideration when it considered its sentencing. It did not discard anything, but did give more weight to moral character, mentality, the inclination to commit crime, the criminal record, and poor rehabilitation aspects. So the circuit court did view everything that it had at its disposal, found some information weighing more heavy than others, and made its determination that Lanphier deserved two life sentences for his conduct. And that is, again, for the fact finder. At trial, we tell the jury they are the ones who are responsible for getting all the information, weighing the evidence, and determining who's telling the truth. Whose weight are we going to give more credibility to? The same with the circuit court in this situation. In this case, the circuit court properly sentenced Lanphier. It had all of the information it needed at its disposal and sentenced him appropriately. He sentenced the man before him. And therefore, the state respectfully requests this court to affirm his sentences. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Miller, you may proceed with rebuttal.
I'd like to address a couple of the things that were stated in Appellee's argument there, or addressed by the court. This idea of harshness has been mentioned in both arguments, and it was stated by Ms. Hanke that there's nothing more than an aggravated assault besides maybe a murder. But we're talking about a Class 2 felony. The legislature's already decided that that's a Class 2 felony, and the proportionality that I've argued that goes along with that. Obviously, above that, you got a Class 1, Class C, Class B, Class A. There's multiple areas on the spectrum that would be significantly higher than the Class 2. I think if you're going to go beyond that on just the basic face of it, because, you know, again, apples to apples on a aggravated assault charge, it could just be fighting with an officer, to using a weapon, to using a vehicle. All of those are still, you know, an aggravated assault against law enforcement. So the statute doesn't put in there any specific, like I was kind of mentioning with the sentencing guidelines, the manner in which it was done or a weapon used or tool used or anything like that. on its face level, it's a Class 2 felony. That's what it is. If you're looking at the harshness and you're going to look at the conduct throughout the pursuit and all of that, I think that that's done in the second prong of the analysis. And in that second prong, that's when we compare it to the other cases and whatnot. And defense had provided to the court a sentencing brief which included 9 different cases from the same jurisdiction, same offense, similarly situated defendants. 3 of those were above that. They were actually charged or sentenced by the exact same trial court, same judge. And those were specifically addressed by the trial court in an attempt to distinguish those, which I'd like to briefly address those. The 3 of them were State v. Rumbolts, State v. Smith, and State v. Hanneman. In the State v. Rumbolts file, the court had mentioned in this case that although there was, and there was less of a criminal history there, it was substantially the same facts. Had high-speed chase over multiple counties. Many individuals were put at risk due to their actions, ended up in a shootout. In the Rumbolts case, that individual actually shot the officer, shot him in the arm. Fled from that last shootout, just like Lanford did, was later captured, and also was charged with 1 count of murder, which was later dismissed. In that case, that defendant received 25 years with 10 years suspended. State v. Smith, the trial court had indicated that this individual was 25 years old, had very little criminal history, and stated he had not used a weapon. Although, again, I would agree that he wasn't using a weapon at the time he was viciously beating the officer. He did attempt to burn a gas station, attempted to light the gas pumps on fire, essentially creating a bomb and placing many individuals in the homes nearby at risk, as well as first responders. In that case, he severely injured an officer who was hospitalized for a serious amount of time, and for that aggravated assault, he received 20 years with 66 days credit. In the State v. Hanneman file, again, the trial court distinguished by pointing out limited criminal history and that individual was suffering from mental health issues and that the court had received favorable letters from the sheriff as well as the victim. However, again, very similar to Lanford, it was a high-speed chase covering multiple counties, many individuals put at risk. Instead of using a weapon or starting a gas station on fire, he drove his vehicle directly at the sheriff. And then similar to Hanneman, Lanford was, like we've talked about, suffering from mental health and chemical dependency issues.
Counsel, were any of these defendants on parole at the time of the alleged offenses, the 3 cases you just went through?
I do not know that.
So your client was on parole?
My client was on parole
at the time of this, and for an ag assault?
Yes, I believe it was for the ag assault, yes.
So that's certainly one distinguishing factor.
It would be a distinguishing factor, yes. And you know, and again, when the court considers prior conduct like that, in that instance, the prior aggravated assault, again, shows that although he was trying to escape, I don't think it shows that he was intending to harm any officers. In that one, he was trapped into a garage, and he was backing up into their vehicles and then eventually ended up pushing through the back wall of the garage. But because of his spinning tires, the tires had started on fire and then started the garage on fire. But again, we're talking about escape, not evidence to show that he had the intention to actually to kill anybody. In 2 of these 3 cases, the officer was seriously injured, either by being shot or badly beaten by the defendant. In this case, there was no bullet holes in the vehicles, the vicinity of the officers, nor the buildings or the backdrops, which would indicate that he had no intention to harm them. This is all evidence which is consistent with his stated intent to only scare them back and to escape. These cases that we compared, they didn't just receive a much lower sentence. They received significantly lower sentence than Mr. Lanford, who didn't just receive a slightly higher sentence, but he received essentially the highest sentence he could get by statute, except for to have the cases run consecutive to each other. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. The court will be in recess till 11:15. We'll take up a rules hearing at that time.